Hi, this is Chris, host of A Couple of Drips. Just before we start, I wanted to say a quick word about our subscribers' memberships. If you'd like to help support future episodes, you can subscribe to the show for a few pounds a month. This'll help fund production, coffee, and guest expenses. Simply click on the support button in the episode description. Cheers, and enjoy the show.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Grab a cup, settle in, and turn it up. It's time for A Couple of Drips Mental Health Special. Please welcome your host, bringing the issues to the table and hoping to perk you up, it's Chris Granger.
Hello, and welcome to the second episode of the Mental Health Specials. It's ladies' night tonight. We've got two of my very good friends and two mental health professionals here to juxtapose when we have the lads in who were mental health service users. Please welcome my very good friends, Tanya Morgan and Harriet Summerfield. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
How are you both?
Okay,
thank you. That was beautiful stereo there, both of you coming in like that. If we sound a bit different today, it's because we've got three people we're recording in the kitchen rather than in the studio, and it's a little bit more echoey, so you'll have to forgive us for that, and there might be the odd bit of traffic noise because it's not as sound insulated, but I think we'll get by. So I'll turn to you first of all, Tanya. Tell us what you do and what your relationship to mental health is.
Okay, I'm a psychotherapeutic counsellor by trade, but I also am a specialist mental health mentor and work with a lot of university students. And I also do a little bit of life coaching. So I've been doing this probably for about 6 years, something like that, and love it, absolutely love it.
And Harriet?
Yeah, I'm a psychotherapist and counsellor. I've got a base in Stone and also in Newcastle-under-Lyme. Also work with clients on Zoom or telephone and also outdoors for walk and talk sessions.
That's very interesting. Tell us a little bit more about the walk and talk. That sounds like an interesting area.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I'm very passionate about it. And the people that have chosen to do it, in my experience, are usually quite passionate about the outdoors and being in nature. So it's something that really fits with them. And it's a wonderful way to work outdoors with people.
I imagine it feels a lot more relaxed than a formal environment where you're in an office. And
yeah, I think you have to be mindful of not being too informal because... Yeah. It would be easy to think, am I going for a walk with a friend? Like,
yeah,
I might do because I'm walking side by side.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes I do have to be mindful that this person isn't a friend. They're someone that I'm working with therapeutically. Yeah. But it certainly does offer a different dynamic.
So that presents you with a challenge as well as the person receiving the therapy, I guess.
It can be a challenge, you know, the sort of unpredictability of being outdoors. Mm. You know, for instance, we came across one time a dog that was lost when we were outdoors. So, you know, that sort of brought issues up for the person that I was with in terms of sense of responsibility. You know, what do we do with this scenario?
Yeah.
And we had to sort of work things out together in terms of how we were going to handle that. So, but, you know, for some people, I think they really like not having to have intense eye contact because you're walking side by side.
Yeah, that's a good point.
For some people, the distractions of nature and the unpredictability of nature can be really helpful. So when people might feel very overwhelmed with, say, talking about trauma or talking about, say, loss or a bereavement, the idea that, you know, a bird could swoop by and sort of regulate them and help them not feel totally overwhelmed by the emotions that they might be experiencing. For some people, that can be really, really helpful.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And Tanya, where does your realm kind of fit? Because I know you work at universities, but you also work independently as well. What sort of things do you encounter, and where do you see yourself fitting in with a person's mental health voyage, as it were?
So with pre-pandemic, I used to go into the universities and talk with the young people there. But the pandemic came along and I thought, oh, my goodness me, that's it. My life's over and I'm never going to be able to do therapy again. And how am I going to get a connection, therapeutic connection with people? And I have been very pleasantly surprised. Mm. And what I do is I speak regularly with the people I am working with, predominantly university students. And from the comfort of their own homes or their own environments, they will talk about what's going on with them. I come across students who have a lot of anxiety, depression. Also, there are quite a few students I work with who are autistic or on the autistic spectrum. So it's about emotional regulation and organizational skills and things like that. So it's a real broad spectrum of people that I deal with. I have people that I talk to who are bipolar. They have psychosis. So it's a real hodgepodge of things.
Yeah.
And I think it's about developing a connection with people and allowing you into their space because you're looking into their room and they're opening up about things that are very personal to them. And they are giving you access to their worst thoughts, feelings and emotions or what's going on inside of them. And it's quite a privilege for people to really, really be very open and honest with you.
Mm.
And I do have a lot of young people, and luckily not that many, who live with suicidal ideation. Mm. And being able to talk about that seems to help them to regulate their moods and stuff.
Yeah.
Also, I come across a lot of people who will self-harm. And again, talking about that sort of thing. And not judging people for doing things. So it's a very rewarding experience, exhausting at times, but it is rewarding.
Yeah. And Harriet was saying about how people can be more relaxed in a non-formal environment. You're talking to a lot of people in their own homes on kind of Zoom calls and things
absolutely,
like that.
Absolutely.
And you find that removes a barrier as well.
It absolutely does. First of all, they don't have to. Say, for instance, somebody's having a really bad mental, what I call a bad mental health day. Their anxieties are high, their mood's low. They can quite easily just sit up in bed, if they should wish to, and just talk on a Teams call to me. And I'll say things like, well, you know, have you had anything to eat this morning? Well, no, I haven't. A lot of them are on medication, quite strong. Have you had your medication? Well, no, I haven't. Have you had a No, I haven't. So I'll talk through. I'll say, right, okay, go and get yourself a glass of water or a cup of tea and a biscuit and take your medication and then we'll start.
Yeah.
So it kind of helps them to get their day rolling.
Yeah.
And talking about things that they don't want to talk to their parents about or their peers because they don't want to appear to be weak.
Yeah.
And I love it, absolutely love it, and it works.
Do either of you find that there is a certain group of people that doesn't work for, that they want the conventional face-to-face?
Yeah, definitely. I, you know, going into private practice at a point in the pandemic when face-to-face hadn't been really an option for many, many people, you know, online sessions, telephone sessions, outdoor sessions were the only real options during significant parts of the pandemic. So I was unsure, you know, what the demand for face-to-face in a room was going to be further down the pandemic. But I've been surprised, actually, that there is that demand there, and it's probably a greater demand than I was expecting it to be. Whether people have sort of gone back to default ways of sort of operating. But, you know, having those choices there for people, I think, is really important. Just on the online aspect, Tanya, as you were saying, I think there's, I don't know if you've experienced this as well, but I think sometimes because people can be so familiar with working online on Zoom or Teams or whatever, that there's potential for the disinhibition effect, that people sometimes might sort of overshare things too early about themselves that then may feel a bit uncomfortable about. So it's, you know, for me, you know, this isn't with everyone that I work with, but sometimes it's just being mindful of that as well.
I would agree with that. I do have people who share a lot very quickly. And if they do share something that is quite heavy, mm-hmm. at the end of the session, I'll say, I'd like to thank you for trusting me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've been very brave to say that. Mm-hmm. And you know, are you okay? And just do all of the normal checks. Mm. And I think if I, by doing that, I'm helping them to come to terms with what they are, what the what's going on inside. And so, although I see where you're coming from, for me it's the opposite. Mm-hmm. If they get in there and come out with significant things to start with, it's like a big relief for them. It's like them sort of like, that feels so much better. And then we can move on from there. Mm. But I do check in with them afterwards. It's slightly different to pure counselling, the mentoring side, is that if somebody's disclosed to me, for instance, if somebody has disclosed to me that they were abused as a child, for instance, and they'll talk about it and I'll say, well, that was obviously very, very big thing for you to talk about, and no child, that should happen to no child. Just check with them, check that they're okay. I will also signpost them to specialist organisations who deal with things like that. And then maybe a day after, a couple of days later, I'll just send them a quick WhatsApp, you know, just checking in on you. Are you okay? What's going on?
Yeah, that's great. Well, before it gets cold, shall we do the coffee? All together now. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so Tanya, what are we drinking?
I need to get my glasses. I can't.
Harrod's glasses as well. I just.
They're not Harrod's glasses. It's a mucky Harrod's glass. Packed coffee. You're asking a dyslexic to say that.
Yeah, absolutely.
La Descaresa espresso. It's an espresso.
Okay.
How do I say that?
La Pedregosa. La Pedregosa espresso. It's a micro lot, light roast from Pack Subscription. And it's supposed to have hints of, well, I won't tell you what it's supposed to have hints of. We'll taste it first and you can see if you can taste hints of. So give it a slurp. And to give it a good taste, get some air in there so that you mix the coffee with air, the taste buds. So the way to do that is just thoroughly spray it. You have to do the slurp. Preferably not dribble it all down yourself. So.
I tell my son off for doing that when he was little.
That just means you get air in there. So when it's hitting the tongue, it's hitting all of the tongue at once, but also it's oxygenizing it, like you do with, you know, when you open a bowl of red wine and you need to stand it for half an hour before the taste develops. Mm. Now, I know Harriet's done a coffee tasting before because she's Jamie's wife, who we've had on previously. And
fellow coffee fiend
who was in last night doing a special actually with a Jamaican Blue Mountain, but you and Jamie did the world's biggest coffee tasting, and that was how you got into coffee tasting, wasn't it?
It was a fun experience actually. It was one of those things that you never would have done before, but because of the pandemic and you couldn't do anything else, there was no cafes, shops open. We did that. And it was a really fun thing to do actually.
I mean, Kelly, my partner's not a coffee drinker, but she even did it with me because there was so little going on at the time, you know. But
I mean, I've always been a tea drinker, proper tea drinker, But I can see the benefits of coffee as well now.
Yeah.
You know, in your jingle earlier when it said, and it's better than tea, well, you know.
Yeah. I'm with you on that one. I'm a tea drinker.
It's debatable, is it?
There's a story I'll tell you off mic about that jingle. But yeah. No, so what do you think of this one? Because you've definitely got, I know you've definitely got the taste for coffee because Jamie gave me full notes from the coffee day of which you liked. And what your favourite was and what you got out of it.
Is there a bit of blackcurrant?
Okay.
It doesn't taste chocolatey. It's quite light, isn't it?
Okay. What about you, Tony? Can you get anything from it or just coffee?
Just coffee.
Just coffee.
Sorry.
No aftertaste, no fruity aftertaste?
Let me have a little go.
Okay.
There's definitely fruit there, isn't there?
Mm.
I was thinking blackcurrant.
Orangey.
It's quite, yeah, fruit is quite common with a sort of light roast. The tasting notes say cherries, plum and lemon.
Mm. Citrusy and dark fruity.
There we go. So what do you think? Would you marks out of 10?
Very nice. I think my difficulty with coffee is I'm so used to drinking tea when it's almost scaldingly hot that I've had to learn to not
better.
Drink coffee when it's scaldingly hot.
Yeah, so, about 68 is about 68 degrees is about right. To drink coffee.
And have changed from drinking coffee with milk to drinking it black, and I'm perfectly happy drinking it black now.
It took me a while to adjust, but that when you realize that the thing on the fridge says it all really.
Don't ask for cream or sugar.
the thing is, once you start drinking artisan coffees, you can't taste the subtle differences if you start putting milk and sugar in it. So
I've stopped drinking caffeine after midday to kind of help with my sleep, generally.
Right. Yeah.
Today's obviously an exception.
Mm-hmm.
But occasionally I've found...
You'll be texting me at 3 a.m. going, it's your fault!
I found a really good decaf.
Oh, right.
Where apparently they don't strip the chemicals out like they do in some others, at Clover Cafe in town.
Oh, nice. I've not tried their coffee, I must admit.
Please try their decaf. I know you're probably not a decaf person, but it's really, really good.
Well, Dave brought round on the special show last night. Dave brought round some decaf he's got from work. And there's two ways of making a decaf. One is with you put solvents in and it dissolves all the caffeine, which is what you're talking about. And that's not very good because you get a little bit of solvent left in the coffee. Which is not great. But the more expensive process is the Swiss water decaf, which is where it's filtered through water and it doesn't take all of the caffeine out because you can't completely dissolve all of the caffeine unless you use solvent. But it takes the majority of it out, but there's no chemicals involved. Mm. So that's the better process. It's like 0.11 of percent of caffeine left in it.
So. Yeah.
That's but I haven't tried that yet. But it's full enough now.
I'd drink that.
You would drink that?
Yes, it's very nice. Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. We'll move on now. One of the topics that we mentioned was lockdown. What kind of problems did you sort of encounter during lockdown? What sort of things did you come across during lockdown, that mental health issues that perhaps hadn't arisen before, either of you?
I think people's anxiety went through the roof.
Mm.
I think the daily news the daily broadcasts about what was happening in the country and how many people were dying and stuff, that really triggered quite a number of health anxieties. And I also found that people who had a propensity towards agoraphobia became even more agoraphobic than before.
I'll put my hand up and admit to that one. Yep, definitely.
Yeah. And it just... For a lot of people, it was a scary time because they were told they were going to die.
Mm.
And often when we're faced with the potential of our own mortalities, it is a scary prospect.
Yeah. I would certainly say that my anxiety about going outside grew a lot. I mean, I didn't see my partner for 7 weeks because until Boris talked about the bubble. My mum was on chemotherapy at the time and her mum has dementia, so... We didn't want to put either of them in jeopardy kind of thing. Mm. So, but then certainly, you'll remember this, Tanya, but when we had a meeting and they said, do you want to return to face-to-face work in the building? I was like, No. Absolutely not.
Yeah,
no.
Me too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, selfishly, because you can see more students and you can make more money if you're not waiting in cold corridors and things. But we never had a permanent office base, so we were always sitting in the foyer of the library.
Mm.
I remember when the pandemic first started, it took a week for the university to kind of close. And I must have walked past 3,000 students in that week, sitting in that foyer. You know, I had a little cough. I don't know whether it was COVID, but I was certainly ill the week after. It was before you could get the tests and everything as well. But did we want to return to that? Well, for me, it was a no, partly because you can see more students if you're doing it virtually. But secondly as well, my gran was very agoraphobic, and I've definitely inherited that. If I can stay at home and not go out, you know, what someone say to me, what's your perfect holiday destination? I would say having 2 weeks at home and not having to go anywhere. You know, it's I do travel. I have traveled and I forced myself to do it, but I do have to force myself to do it. And certainly being locked in for 7 weeks, the idea of then going out, and when I went on walks, when you bumped into people, it wasn't just because they may have the virus or whatever, but it was just, oh, it's far too people-y out here. You know, I certainly felt a lot of that anxiety.
That's just sort of triggered something within me. I was talking to somebody the other day, and they struggle with crowds and are very anxious. And they were going to, I don't know, somewhere by the seaside. So let's say Rill, for instance, they're going to seaside, and they said, well, I'm really not sure if I can cope with the crowds. I'm not sure. I think I'll just stay by the caravan. I said, no. You will go and you will mix with the crowds because you're with your family and those people that you're comfortable with. Because when you return to the university environment in October, there will be a lot of people there. And I think you need to start integrating and mixing with people. If you feel uncomfortable, just walk away. Just go and find a quiet spot.
I think as well, you know, some people whose jobs suddenly became working from home during the pandemic, you know, over many, many months, years, have sort of got potentially trapped in a routine that's not very healthy, though, because everything's so convenient being online, isn't it? If you're on Teams, you're potentially accessible all the time. You don't have that social contact that you might have if you were working in an office, you know, bumping into colleagues, having a chat whilst making a cup of tea, you know, stretching your legs, literally walking around, you know, maybe popping out to fetch a sandwich or, you know, do some shopping in your break. I think for some people, that has meant that working at home, they felt increasingly isolated because that little bit of social contact that they might have had in a working day has been completely stripped out. And also I think sometimes there's a feeling like I'm chained to my desk and this screen and, you know, can I leave the house? You know, am I allowed to leave the house? Is that I shouldn't be doing that. These are my working hours. People can't stare at a screen for 8 hours without it affecting their eyesight or their mental health, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
That's interesting. When we first started on the video, my eyes would water, really, really water.
Oh, really?
So it was terrible, really tired eyes. So I ended up, when we could go to the opticians and they gave me some glasses that sort of for distance for a screen and for reading, it's the way, they're not bifocals, but not quite. But just to sort of talk about getting out of the house from a personal perspective, I make myself have a routine every day and I sort of get myself up, dressed and all the rest of it in the morning. And I've got a little dog, so I take the dog for a walk. So I'm walking to work every morning. So taking the dog for a walk is me walking to work.
Yeah. Good.
And then at the end of the day, my routine is, come on, we're going to go for a walk. And then I'm walking home from work.
Yeah.
So that forms part of my routine. And it seems to work for me. And also for me, dressing for work. I've always got dressed for work, wearing a dress or something like that. I do have dress down Fridays sometimes, but you know, that helped me. And I would always encourage people during the pandemic and even now, get into a routine.
Yeah.
You know, get into a routine. Decide that you're going to wake up within a time frame. Do what you need to do within that time frame. Yeah. But incorporated in that, there has to be some sort of outside activity.
Yeah.
Fresh air.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, I encourage people as well to have, to try and have some routine discipline around technology as well, you know. So if you're working at home, make sure when you've finished your work that your laptop's out of sight, that, it, you know, put it in a drawer. You know, don't have it out on the kitchen table. So you're going to see it.
Try and work in a different room if you can.
Yeah, if you can work in a different room. Not everyone had sort of the ability to do that in the pandemic. Some people were working on their beds, weren't they? You know, because there was literally children in the house. There was no spare room. Mm. You know, it was a very, very challenging time, I think, for a lot of people. And the world outside has felt quite scary for many people, and it's been a great source of anxiety.
Yeah, I think the ritual thing is a very positive action. I certainly have a kind of work ritual. I wish it was walking around the block, but unfortunately it isn't. But it's brewing the coffee in the morning, making the coffee in the morning before work, you know, making sure I've got the coffee ready for the time. And the process of making coffee itself is somewhat of a ritual for me. Mm. And that's kind of the one thing that through lockdown was thing that I would always make the coffee, and I would always make it between sort of 10 and 11 in the morning. Mm. And it would always be, and that was the one bit of ritual, or the one bit of routine, I should say, that I did have during the pandemic. And that kind of, you do need that ritual, because there is the danger of falling into kind of strange sleep patterns and, you know, just a Groundhog Day as well, you know, everything becoming.
And to stay in your pyjamas all day. It's easy to stay in your pyjamas all day.
Exactly. Yeah.
With a lot of the young people that I work with, I'll be talking to them and they'll be in their jimmy jammies, and I'll say, well, look, I don't mind if you put another clean pair of pyjamas on, but get yourself updressed, showered, changed, put a clean pair of pyjamas on. But just change, just get that change in place.
I think it's about, sometimes the boundaries can become very blurred, can't they? And work and home can become very much one, and that's not good for your mental health because you don't have that differentiation, do you? So, being able to get up, have a shower, put some different clothing on can make a really big difference. Yeah.
And there is that danger, and I think it's something that happened a lot through lockdown, is that if you get that email at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, you'll respond to it straight away because you've been working from home all day and you're still at home. You're still in that same environment and you've been responding to emails all day. So why shouldn't you answer one at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night? And that's a danger, and it's definitely something I'm guilty of.
Mm. And it also, you know, if you respond to that email at 7 o'clock at night, it then fuels another response.
Yeah.
So you're kind of speeding up the communication, which actually the world isn't going to end. You know, that issue could wait. It's not life and death. It could wait till the morning.
Yeah.
So
I'm definitely guilty of doing that. I'll just get this response done. Whereas actually what I should do is just put a flag on the email to remind myself to do it tomorrow. You know.
Or just not look at it.
Yeah, or just not look at it.
After that certain time.
Terrible, you know.
We have a phone that's gone.
Yeah, it's got the email on it.
And, put the phone in a drawer after a certain time. Turn it off.
It is tempting to do that, I must admit.
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to be productive at work, to be able to have a break and to have some respite from work, you know, being available, not necessarily 24/7, but being available 12 hours a day or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't think it's good for your mental health. I think it's really important to have that downtime and respite from it and come at it afresh the next day or, you know, the following Monday or whenever.
Yeah, and you will be fresh and your response will be better. You know, it'll be more considered. You know, if I fire off an email at 8 o'clock at night or whatever, it's going to be the quickest I can fire off in order to deal with whatever situation or scenario is arising. You know, it won't be like if I'm answering it 10 o'clock on a Monday morning, you know, when kind of I've got time to respond and it's what I allot as my work time rather than invading on my time kind of thing. But there's that thing as well that if you respond at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night, people expect you to always respond at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. It becomes difficult to switch off, doesn't it? Yeah, definitely.
You were talking when we're talking about sort of areas in the pandemic, like everybody else, I had university students of my own, one upstairs, one in the conservatory, and somebody somewhere else. So I was sort of in
these are your children. Yes, just clarify.
My children. No, my children.
Kidnapped a couple of university students.
My children, my grown-up children.
Yeah.
And I would be in the sitting room. And during the working day, I'd sit in one chair in the sitting room. And then if I was watching television, I would not sit in that chair. I'd sit in a different chair.
Yeah. I've been reading a book recently about meditation, and I think it's called Frantic World Meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about routine and how that's really important to kind of help manage anxiety as well.
Mm.
But the interesting thing that I've learned is sometimes we can become very constrained by our routines as well.
Yeah.
So the idea of being able to mix up a routine occasionally, just as an example, say, you know, if you drive from here to, say, Newcastle on a regular basis and you always go the same route, why not mix it up and go a slightly different route? You know, don't go massively out of your way. Go a slightly different route. And because you're going a slightly different route, your brain is becoming more mindful. You're more aware. You're not on autopilot, basically. Mm. So it's a more kind of relaxing, therapeutic, meditative experience because you're mixing it up. And also it means that potentially the outside world isn't so scary because you can handle a little bit of change. Mm. Yeah? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And funny you should say that. When I take the dog for a walk, I do not go the same way all the time. I sort of do different routes just for a change. And also when I'm encouraging people to get outside, I find out where they're comfortable going to. And some of them might have a park or some of them might be going to the supermarket. And I'll say, well, just literally go to the end of the road and back again.
Mm.
And then go a little bit further and back again. Or I think to start with, a familiar route is something that will help with the anxiety.
Yeah.
But then afterwards, I completely agree.
Mm.
But dealing with people who have, in my experience, significant anxiety, to do any form of meditation triggers their anxiety because it's like focusing on the breathing and everything. Mm. Well, that for some people just
for everyone.
That pulls on a full panic attack for some people. Mm. So it works with some, but you can do what I would call active meditation, which is probably pretty much what you're doing when you're going outside, walking around, looking at the environment, being mindful of what's going on around you.
I think walking for me during lockdown was the one thing that kind of kept me sane, you know. I started wanting to do more exercise as well, but I was aware that with everyone in lockdown, I needed to do it. And I was guilty of the same thing when I first started it. I was doing the same route every day. And then I realised, no, you know, you need to explore. You need to have the routine of going to do it. But you don't need to do the same route every single day. You need to kind of vary it for that.
Mm.
And it did help me a lot during lockdown, not just with my physical health, but definitely with my mental health, because even though I found it difficult running into people, the fact that I ran into people means I was getting that contact, which means it made the agoraphobia slightly less than it would have been, you know.
Yeah. I found myself during lockdown that I've always enjoyed being out, well, not always, but more recently enjoyed being outdoors. But I would only really have ever gone for a walk with someone else.
Mm.
But because of lockdown, I found that I was walking by myself quite a number of times in a week. And I really enjoyed that.
Because, you can walk. You're like an Olympic walker, aren't
you?
You do some serious routes, some serious distances. I look at some of the distances you and Jamie do and I'm like, wow.
But what I loved, and again, about it being a sort of mindful experience, was particularly in that first lockdown, was places that I'd had walked regularly, locally, I was much more aware of them. I was much more aware of, you know, certain flowers coming out during this month, and then they die back and then something else emerges. And I found this brilliant app, which I still use now and again, called Seek.
Right.
So you can take a photograph, and I was suddenly looking at all these weeds on the side of country lanes and thinking, oh, I wonder what that is. And You can zoom in on your smartphone, take a photograph of the plant or the creature or whatever, and it will tell you what it is. And it will tell you, you know, where it comes from. Is it native to the UK? Is it... I found it absolutely fascinating. Brilliant. So now I go for a walk by myself and I'm much more mindful and think, oh, yeah,
You're noticing the environment around you. That starts to bloom in the spring.
Blackthorn, for instance, is one of the first things that comes into bloom in the spring, and it's probably like February or March. Mm. You know, it's really early and it's got such a beautiful little pretty flower.
Yeah.
I would never have even noticed it before. And now I kind of think, I clock it.
Yeah.
I clock it each year.
Brilliant, brilliant. There's certainly that, isn't there? It's so easy to go for a walk and the walk is the focus and you don't notice what's around you, you know. You don't notice your surroundings and you don't really take them in and you don't really get the benefit of it.
Mm.
But I think I definitely noticed the surroundings a lot more during lockdown. Mm. You know, you go in the walk, but you're actually looking around, because if it's the only time you're leaving the house during the day, you feel like you've got to get something out of it, you know.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, did you do much walking, Evelyn?
Oh, I did, yeah.
With your dog, I guess you
would. Well, I did with the dog, but also I had some... I've got some lovely friends in the village I live in, and we did this one walk one day. Obviously, it was just too far, and where I live, it ended up being a 3-hour walk over hills and far away. And I went to areas that I hadn't seen before, but it was beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And, you know, the kids and I would all go out for a walk of an evening anyway, just to get them out the house too. Mm. So it was nice.
Mm.
It worked well.
Now, I'm just looking at, we did a shared mood board on, what's the app called? I forgot my name.
Miro,
thank you. We did a shared mood board on here. One of the things you've written down, Hattie, is mental health tsunami. Do you like to tell us what you were referring to by that?
Yeah, I think probably lots of people, whether you worked in mental health or not, you know, and it's across the whole of the healthcare sector, isn't it, that, you know, we're coming towards the end of the pandemic now, mm. and what this is August, isn't it, 2022?
Mm-hmm.
But we knew 2 years ago what the impact of 2 years ago was going to be in the future. So, you know, we've touched on it already, haven't we? That, you know, people being sort of isolated at home in a different environment, a very much different way of working and operating. Limited access to friends and loved ones, a complete change in people's social world, pressure on health services, you know, limited funding pre-pandemic to mental health services, certainly, and now, you know, people have greater need of mental health services, I think, because of the pandemic and the implications of it. So, you know, I think we're experiencing that now. And, you know, some of the people that I've come across in the last year or so, you know, are very much young people. And you'll be the same, Tanya, won't you, with the students that you're working with. You know, there's some very young people that are reaching out for mental health services. And I'm really proud that they are as well, because I don't know if a generation ago... those young people would necessarily have reached out, or whether the services would have been so kind of in the public domain as perhaps they are now.
I completely agree. I think that the younger generation that is around now, the younger ones, they're very, very self-aware. They're very aware of what is their normal and what's not their normal. And they're aware of their triggers if they have significant mental health. If they've lived with their mental health conditions for such a long time, they know what their triggers are, they know what to do to look after them. And a lot of them are trying their hardest to do stuff for themselves, to help themselves. And unfortunately, a lot of them are being let down by the mental health services because they're underfunded and oversubscribed.
Mm.
But it is, as you say, it's good that they are reaching out.
Mm.
That leads me on nicely to a question I wanted to ask, actually, which was, do you think that there are more mental health problems nowadays, or do you think it's just with the media and it being included in so many areas that we're just more aware of it and more willing to ask for help?
I think that there are more people with mental health issues. Yes, there have been people who've had depression and anxiety over the years, but society and life has changed so much. So we've got things like social media. We've got all of the sort of technology at our fingertips. So we all know what's going on. And I think that puts a pressure. When I was younger, if I was going to meet up with friends, I'd say to them, right, I'll meet you at such and such a place at such and such a time. And we'd do that, or we'd use the sort of house phone or stuff like that. And I think the sort of the instant access to knowing what people are doing, I think is having a negative impact, without question.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, maybe particularly with young people, because you've got such ready access to smartphones and technology that, you know, you might have fallen out with someone that day, as, you know, as young people do, and that's normal, isn't it? But, you know, what would have happened perhaps when I was a teenager is you'd have had a period of time between then and the next day, maybe a bit of time to calm down, a bit of time to reflect, work things out in your head, as may the other person. And maybe sometimes you could have started afresh, but I think having ready access to a smartphone and social media is sometimes it can add fuel to the fire. And, so you know, a falling out earlier in the day can suddenly have escalated into something really enormous by midnight because you've got access to that technology.
And I don't think it's just younger people. I think sort of any generation can be badly affected by what they see on social media and, and the perceived fun or perfection or whatever is going on out there. And it is a concern. And for a lot of young people, they will say, I'm talking to so-and-so. They don't mean they're physically talking through their, you know, using their mouth. Yeah. They're using their keyboard to talk to people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got friends. I'm talking to my friends. Okay, where are your friends? Are they local? No, they're all over the world. So it's the what I call the physical contact and connection where they're actually sort of walking down the street or sitting on the park bench yakking away. It happens, but not as much. And again, that gets back to the agoraphobia.
Yeah.
And do you think the fact that, obviously it's a positive thing that the media are more aware of mental health and talking about mental health now, it is easier to ask for help now because it's not sort of stigmatised as it used to be?
I would agree with that. However, because the mental health services are so stretched, and I'm talking about sort of the National Health Services, not private services, for a lot of people, they have to wait a really, really long time to get into some sort of therapy. And a lot of the time, they're offered group therapy, which, because they're not very good with people, they'll just sit there and they won't say anything. So it's kind of, it's a complicated situation.
Yeah, and also, I guess, you know, NHS, mental health services, in order to access them, you've got to be at a more extreme end of the scale. But what about the people in the middle that might, you know, if there isn't some support or intervention, are they then going to tip into that more extreme end? You know, isn't it about sort of preventative services and trying to keep people out of the more intensive, expensive services?
I guess
services.
If you're on a waiting list for 2 years, the problem could be a lot worse by the time you're actually...
Exactly. So, you know, it's really hard. I think anyone working in mental health services in the NHS at the moment, you know, it's a challenging job, you know. Yeah. Money's less, you know, time and resources are less, where demand is increasing probably month on month.
Yeah, I know the idea for me of sitting in a group therapy session, I mean, you know, kind of the idea of having a one-to-one with a therapist, I know that's what you both do for a living, but I find that didn't... You know, when my mum died, my dad and my sister both saw counsellors, but that didn't feel like it was for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but maybe something like your out and about walking and talking thing, it seems like... Yeah. Maybe it's... My problem with it is maybe the formalised situation, the formalised scenario.
You know? Or you weren't ready.
That's a very good point, actually.
And I think readiness is actually very important because there's some people that are absolutely ready. You know, I've had enough of feeling this way and living this way.
Mm.
I need things to change. And there's some real motivation with some people. Yeah. Other people, you know, might have had friends, family, people at work say, oh, you know, maybe you'd benefit from this kind of thing, and they're not sure and they're not ready. And you know, for some people, depending on what the topic is, it can be a really difficult journey to go through, and you have to be prepared to go sort of through some of the difficult things to be able to come out the other side feeling perhaps a bit less burdened and a little bit less weighted down by some of those things.
Yeah, I would agree completely. I think therapy isn't for everybody.
Mm.
It's just not. Some people might get comfort in just talking to their mates or having a cup of coffee with some pals. It's not for everybody, but it should be available to everybody. And my bugbear is that it's not.
Mm.
And as you said, people are waiting for years. They can wait for years and years and years just to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, Kelly said an interesting thing to me after Mum died, which was, you're dealing with it very well, to which my response was, no, I'm not dealing with it.
No.
I'm not dealing with it well, I'm just not dealing with it. I've put it in a pigeonhole.
And when I'm working with people that have experienced loss, you know, loss of someone very close to them, you know, I often think, you know, grief is something that you can pause.
Mm.
But you can't put it off.
Right.
So, you know, you can press the pause button and you can, you know, people will find a million and one other things to distract themselves and keep busyness a really good way of doing that.
Yeah.
But those times when you are more alone with your own thoughts because you can't be busy 24/7 are the times, I guess, when it's going to sort of really hit home for you. But people have to be ready to engage with it if they want to do that.
I think the thing with a loss due to somebody passing is that it's not one of these things that you get over. You just learn to live with how you're feeling. And the longer period of time that goes on, it's still there, but it gets a little less painful each year as it goes along.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things you've mentioned to me, Tanya, is the five ways of well-being. Would you like to explain what that is for anyone listening who might not be aware of that?
Okay, well, the five ways of well-being is a fairly simple thing, really. One of them is to stay connected. So stay connected, talking to your friends, your families. And I don't mean just sort of over a video call. Go for a walk, sort of walk outside and stuff like that. And converse with people.
Mm.
And I think sometimes people don't talk enough. They might talk on a computer screen or with text, but not talking enough. Another is be active. Now, I'm not talking about going to the gym and going on the runner and, you know, run machine or all the rest of it. It's getting outside. It can be walking, you know, speed walking or whatever, dancing in your kitchen, anything, you know, just do something to get the blood pumping around. And also sort of taking notice, look at what's going on around you. So mindfulness, being mindful could be just looking at some flowers and thinking, I really like the colour of that flower, how many different pinks are in it and all the rest of it, or watching a bird swoop down and so forth. Also with learning, now a lot of young people going to school, like, I don't want to learn anything, but we can all learn something new, even if it's just sort of going on one of these free online courses and just learning something, learning a new skill, learning how to knit, learning how to crochet, crafting, drawing, gardening, anything, just something different. And also giving is really important, helping other people. So it might be that you have a neighbour who doesn't get out very much and just knocking on the door and saying, do you want anything from the shop or anything like that?
Do you think that's about feeling a sense of purpose and about distracting somewhat from your own issues by helping someone else with theirs?
Absolutely, absolutely. And then the way you can break it down is you can look at what's important to you about the various things, so connecting, being active, taking notice, keep learning, giving. You then, you know, how are you doing? How are you doing it now? So what am I doing now towards that? And what do I need to change towards those things? Mm-hmm. And what will I do next? So let's use, for example, the being active. So what am I doing now? I'm walking. I'm walking around the pond where I live. What will I do next? Well, I think I'll go further afield. I'll go a little bit further. I might go up the hill and stuff like that. If it's giving, I'm talking to my next door neighbour. So maybe I want to look at the local village or whatever and think, okay, I'll go and pick up some litter or something like that. Just simple things. And even family, you know, giving things to family, time, checking in on people.
Yeah. And again, that follows on from what you were saying about developing a routine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I often talk about you know, things that relate to anxiety, and you know, as negatives. So isolation can be one, and these cross over with what you've talked about as well. You know, so a sense of isolation can be a big cause of anxiety. So get out, connect with other people, connect with the world, connect with nature. A sense of meaninglessness, lack of purpose in someone's life can be a cause of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So like you've suggested as well, find something that's going to give you some meaning, some value, you know, some purpose, something that's going to kind of boost your own self-worth, self-esteem.
Start a podcast.
Exactly
why I did it.
It can be anything, you know, the sort of feeling that you've got a bit of a lack of direction, you know. People aren't always going to have clear, right, I need to be doing this in 2 years' time or whatever. But let's just think about the next few days or the next week, you know, what do you want to kind of get done by this week? So, I think, you know, there's different ways of looking at it, but but encouraging people to connect more, you know, get outside, find something that they enjoy doing, which is going to give them a sense of purpose, I think is really good at helping people that are struggling with anxiety.
I would agree. Talking of anxiety, sort of one of the things that I've noticed dealing with, obviously, a lot of people at university, perfectionism is a trigger for a lot of people's anxiety. And it's, I have to get this absolutely perfect. And if I haven't got it absolutely perfect, I'm going to fail. And then that just triggers a whole tsunami of sort of procrastination and the sort of the inability to function, really. And sometimes it can become really quite problematic. But once we get down to it's okay just to do enough, and when they accept the fact that it's okay to do enough, then they do better. than enough.
Yeah.
And particularly people who are very much artistic. A lot of artistic people are, mm-hmm. and those on artistic type of courses, even computing, where they'd have to make sort of characters and stuff like that. The character has to be perfect, or the drawing has to be perfect.
I can identify with that with myself, because I think probably in the past I was a bit of a perfectionist, and you know, I had to kind of feel like I was going above and beyond, but I had a word with myself. And I've realised that actually doing sort of 85% is enough, and actually is anything going to be any better if I spend loads more time and a little bit more effort? Yeah, I'll be tinkering around the edges with it probably, but am I going to make it significantly better? And actually, I sometimes tell myself, right, I'm going to give myself exam conditions to do this thing, you know, write whatever or do this job. So I'll set myself like a time limit, you know, an arbitrary time limit. Right, I'll give myself an hour and a half to do this, and I'll just do what I can in this time. So I take the pressure off myself, because for me, the idea of spending an entire day writing something fills me with dread. Whereas if I can just do an hour, hour and a half on something, I find I'm probably so much more productive than if I'd spent 7 hours on it.
Absolutely.
And I feel like, you know, I'm free now because I've done my hour and a half. I can move on to the next thing, and it's not stressing me out anymore because I've done what I can within the time that was available.
So you've put very clear boundaries in for yourself, and I think boundaries are important. One thing that I did want to mention was that when people are very... We sort of talked about anxiety and sort of agoraphobia, but depression is something that I come across a lot, I'm sure you do as well. And often when people are very, very depressed, daily functioning is a challenge. And so when we get to talking with people who are sort of challenged in that way, I'll say to them, rather than taking a day at a time, let's take an hour at a time. You know, in that hour, you can get out of bed. You've got out of bed, give yourself a tick. The next hour, you've gone and had a shower, give yourself a tick. You've got something to eat. So I think it's about not putting too much pressure on people to do everything at once. It has to be done in stages.
Yeah. Or it becomes very, very overwhelming, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And then it's difficult to achieve anything.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm. I think that all ties in with what you said about the importance of having a routine, but also having that space where you might work for an hour and a half, but then you move out of that space, you move out of that zone of feeling that, particularly if you're working from home, that your living space is your working space as well. You know, if you've said to yourself, I'm going to give 85% and not 100, I'm going to give myself exam conditions to work on this, I'm not going to keep tinkering with it and keep tinkering with it. I think that helps draw the divisions there. But do you think that desire to have perfection, do you think that comes a lot from social media and the fact that what everybody else is doing is immediately visible and available? And I certainly end up comparing myself to other people. You know, podcasts, for instance, I look at other people's podcasts. Have they got 12,000 followers? You know, have they done this? Have I done that? And I end up not judging myself on the quality of the thing I've produced, but on how successful everyone else is.
I've found that, you know, perfectionism can often come from people's childhood experiences of expectations being, you know, particularly high, and, you know, you will achieve, and, you know, it's expected of you that you of course you're going to do well in your exams, of course you're going to go to university, of course you're going to do that because that's what's expected. And and maybe some people that don't have a huge amount of praise from, you know, childhood, you know, that they're not told, you know, well done and didn't you do well, even for the little things in life, not about the exam grades. You know, it can sort of really impact on people's mental health as they're growing up, and obviously whatever's impacted on your mental health while you're growing up, you take into your adulthood as well.
It stays with you.
Yeah.
I agree with that to a certain point. I know of people who, for instance, when they were growing up, they got an A, and the parents said, well, why didn't you get an A star? So in one hand. But I think it's, for, on the other hand, that a lot of young people, they have aspirations for themselves and feel that they need to achieve 100% of whatever that thing is that they're doing. And they compare themselves to, say they're doing, I don't know, comics or something like that. They're comparing themselves to somebody who's doing comics for 20 years and they've only been doing it for 2.5 at university or 3. So it's the comparison against people who have much more experience and stuff like that and a greater skill because they've been doing it for so long.
Yeah.
Hi there. Chris here, host of A Couple of Drips. If you'd like to help support the production of the show and buy the coffee we try, then you can either buy us a one-off thank you coffee at ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com, or if you'd like to become a member and give us regular support, then click on the support button in your player. Cheers for listening, and on with the show.
So, Tanya, one of the things I've got on my list here is self-care. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I think sometimes people think self-care is just sort of making sure you have a bath, brush your teeth and all the rest of it. But it's slightly more than that. For years, we've been told you are what you eat. And I really do believe that nutritionally, if we have a reasonable diet, and it's sort of quite balanced. I'm not saying don't eat cakes or anything like that, but 80-20 or the vegetables and stuff, that will really help you feel better. Also, engaging in things that you like doing. So for me, I love gardening. And part of my self-care is to get out in the garden and pull up weeds and get my fingernails dirty and just do things like that. And engage in things that you as an individual enjoy doing. For the young people that I work with, a lot of them are into sort of computer games. And I'll say, you know, pick a game that you really like and play it for half an hour at the end of the day just to disengage from what's been going on around you. And it's looking after you and taking responsibility for you because you're the only person that's really going to look after you.
I think what I experienced in terms of my own self-care as a result of the pandemic was because we'd gone from a situation where I was usually really busy at the weekend doing things that I loved and enjoyed doing, you know, sociable things, to going to doing none of that for quite a long period of time because of the pandemic. Obviously, that was a big contrast. But actually, it was really eye-opening for me because I realised that I enjoyed doing nothing sometimes, and I felt like it had taken the pressure off me in some ways, that I didn't have to do too much. I didn't have to see these people. I didn't have to do this. I didn't have to. And I absolutely loved it. So now when things have reopened and we can do pretty much everything that we want to do again, can't we? I'm really, really mindful about not overcommitting to things. To protect my own mental health.
Being willing to say no to people.
Yeah, so, you know,
whereas, and not having to make an excuse just to say, no, I don't want to.
You know, I might have had a scenario where I might have been doing something on a Friday evening and then maybe on the Saturday I was going out for a walk with my husband or doing something with my daughter and then possibly even doing something on the Saturday night and then maybe seeing family on the Sunday. And looking back at that now, that all feels too much. So, you know, spreading things out a little bit more, having a bit of downtime, you know, a day or an evening when there is nothing in the diary is really good for my self-care and for my mental health.
I agree. And I think as well, music's a really good thing to help lift people's spirits or just sort of get them moving around, you know, dance around the kitchen or just to listen and just focus in on something that is, that it's auditory and you don't have to do anything other than just listen.
As a self-confessed introvert, I can although I can come across as an extrovert, but it's very much something I learned when I was teaching, to put on this facade, this face. Being in social situations is fine for me, but afterwards you have to come away from that and recharge. So as you said, Hattie, that downtime, to put that in the diary, to a day where I'm gonna just be by myself or be quiet, whatever, is incredibly important to me, you know.
It's being comfortable in your own skin. That's important.
I think it's absolutely essential. I think, you know, going back to sort of anxiety and depression, you know, if we can feel authentic in ourselves and comfortable in our own skins, that is a really good route to feeling content and okay with life. Being able to, like Chris has described, have a few hours on your own and be perfectly happy with that.
Yeah.
It is a really positive thing to do. We don't need to have 20 friends in our life. You know, your closest friends are probably, you can probably count them on one hand, and that's enough.
I think for me, the thing that they say, that an extrovert is charged up by being around people, and, you know, when an extrovert is around people, you know, they're buzzing and they're on a high from it. And an introvert can be around people and can appear as an extrovert, but then when they come away from that, it's like,
I think my mum always described me as being an extroverted introvert, you know, it's, things can be very exhausting. Just a handful of hours in a social situation can be very, very draining. And I don't think I recognised that until the pandemic, when it caused a sort of natural break, that I wasn't able to do all those things. And then suddenly being able to go back to doing them, I realised how shattering some of them were.
Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely identify with that. A couple of other things I've got written down here. Fight, flight, freeze. Does anyone want to pick up on that one? I mentioned it, but I wasn't sure if you...
Okay, this is quite an interesting one because I deal, obviously, with young people. Well, I deal with younger and old people. But I use an example without giving any names out. One young person I deal with has PTSD, anxiety and depression. And their way of their coping strategy is the fight strategy, but it's not physical fighting, it's verbalizing and sort of shouting and getting louder, because inside they're absolutely terrified and they don't know what to do with themselves. That's that one. The freeze one, again, we come across this a lot within the university setting. There is an assignment due, it has to happen, and it has to be submitted by a certain date. And it's like, oh my goodness, I can't do it, I can't do it. So they're freezing. And the flight thing is they just run away from the whole thing and pretend it doesn't happen and become completely debilitated by it. So it's sort of finding a way of moving past all of that.
And they can often be responses to trauma, can't
they? Exactly, yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, if you think of it in the context of, say, an animal in a stressful situation, you know, there's a poacher out there hunting the animal down. You know, well, what do? They either bolt, they run, they flee, or they freeze. You know, you've seen deer, haven't you? Sort of like... in the headlights, you know, frozen.
Fainting goats.
With fear. Or, you know, animals play dead, don't they?
Yeah.
And you see that with humans as well when they're, you know, being attacked or, you know, trying to be killed, you know, play dead, because then someone might think you're dead and leave you alone. They're survival instincts, aren't they?
Yeah. And I think a lot of the time what happens with all the fight, freeze, suddenly the adrenaline kicks in and that's what gives them the momentum to push forward. So they have the adrenaline rush and they get what they need to have done. And then afterwards they feel completely wiped out, really unwell, and they'll either plummet down and or they have to do another assignment or something else. And it's hard, really hard.
And some people, when they've been experiencing living like that for a long period of time, you know, they're essentially living in the red alert zone, aren't they, all the time? And that can be very damaging, you know, because it's exhausting, it's draining. You're constantly, you know, fearful of something, which may be very innocent. So it's trying to find ways of bringing them back out of that red alert zone into a, you know, everyone has, you know, it's normal to have some level of stress in your life, isn't it? You know, we wouldn't be human if we didn't. So it protects us from danger, doesn't it, to be alert to things, but to constantly live in that way can be very damaging for people's mental health.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that we haven't said, and I would like to say, is that, you know, if you're not feeling great, it is okay not to feel great. It's okay not to be okay. And I think a lot of people, that they're a bit worried that they have to show this strong exterior, particularly men, actually, that, you know, that I am the hunter-gatherer and I'm going to be strong and I'm going to look after my family and do this, that and the other. And, you know, it is okay to say, actually, I'm having a really bad day and I don't feel good.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And do you think a lot of those, I mean, one of the topics I've got down here is media triggers. Do you think a lot of those kind of pressures to fit in and kind of be okay and be normal or be better than normal, be outstanding, is coming from social media and television media? And
I think so, definitely. I think if you see somebody on Instagram or one of the other forums that is looking gorgeous and is successful and does this, that and the other. I mean, phones apparently have filters. I don't know how to use them, but they have filters and they can make you look better than you are. But also, if you see somebody else's success, I've done this, I've done that, this is great in my life.
Mm.
They're not showing you what's not great in their life. You're seeing a 20-second snapshot.
Yeah.
So, you know, they could have, say, for instance, it's a young mother or something. They're not going to tell you that the baby's kept them up for half the night screaming because it's got colic, or that the husband's run off with a nanny or something like that. They're not going to say that. They're going to say, my life is wonderful, because people don't like to hear about bad things, really, do they, on things like social media?
Yeah, and that's certainly the danger, isn't it? You only see that little snapshot of the best, the most polished.
Perfect
life. And, you know, people will look at that and think, why is my life not like that? But it isn't that person's life. It's not a true representation of that person's life.
No.
They might have spent the whole day leading up to that photograph, hiding under the duvet, being fearful of leaving the house. You just don't know, do you?
Yeah. Another thing I've noticed is that the obviously the phones have sort of a newsreel and stuff like that. And quite a few people that I'm talking to, they're sort of saying, Mom, I'm looking at the it's going to get expensive to live. I'm not going to be able to afford to eat. I'm not going to be able to afford to do anything. And there's a war here. There's this happening. There's that happening. And I'm like, disengage.
Mm.
Do not look.
Mm.
Well, it comes on my phone. You don't have to look at it. Mm. You don't have to.
Take the notifications off.
Yes.
You don't certainly have to be alert to everything.
Yeah, with the threats of the, you know, energy price increases and everything, and it's all doom and gloom. You know, it's going to be £5,000 per household, you know, per year, and things like that. I mean, that's a lot of money for young people on basic wage. Well, ladies, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having. Just before we go, there's a couple of mental health charities and mental health organisations that we're going to mention. Hattie, do you want to tell us about Mantime?
Yes, I just noticed the other day on a little bit of Stone's website or Facebook page that they'd mentioned a Stone men's social wellbeing group called Mantime. I think it's probably been going for a little while over the last few months, but it's moving to Granville's in September.
Okay.
So, you know, any men that are looking for a bit of a, you know, opportunity to have a chat, meet with others.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a mental health support group, I don't think. It's just a, you know, if you're feeling isolated and you want to catch up with other people.
Brilliant.
There's an opportunity there.
I'll put a link in the episode blurb to that. That's brilliant. Tanya, what Men's Net?
Okay, there is an organisation called Men's Net, which is I think it's a national thing. But I do know that, and I can't remember the name of it, that there is a men's group that meets on a Monday evening at Stafford Rugby Club. But also what I was going to say is that for anybody, local wellbeing services, you can refer yourselves. You mm-hmm. don't have to go through the doctor.
Yeah.
So you can
that's
self-refer
to
yeah. any local wellbeing service.
That's good to know.
It might be a little bit of a wait, but you can do it yourself if you don't feel comfortable going through the
doctor.
Well,
definitely in the episode description, wherever you get your podcast, we'll put some useful mental health links in there.
I think Mind as well, in North Staffs, they have an online group specifically for men as well, which I think is really successful. So I think it went online during the pandemic, but they've continued. Yeah. And I think that's got some really good engagement with men locally and further afield as well.
I also think a lot of organisations now are becoming very aware of the need to support staff. And so within any organisation, there might be a mental health advocate or somebody who is there to talk to or direct accordingly. Or they might have a service themselves which they utilise.
Yeah, that's definitely increasing. We had Lee Smith on the men's episode and he was talking about, well, he's in fact now the mental health leader at his organisation and they're down in Bristol, but they're very kind of forward thinking now.
Yeah.
And I think firms are becoming gladly increasingly aware of it. So they may be able to have someone to talk to at the organisation you work for. But we'll certainly put in the episode description some links to local and national mental health services, depending on where you're listening from. So.
Some organisations have got mental health first aiders as well. So people that have had some training and are identified people, probably people that have got an interest in mental health and, you know, are sort of keen to support other people.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've not heard of that.
Often bigger organisations, you know, for instance, the NHS would have them. So, you know, there may be a number of people in your organisation if you work there that maybe you could pick up the phone to and have a chat or arrange to meet for a coffee.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to reach out and ask, basically.
And I would urge anybody who is feeling low or anxious or just not themselves, there is always somebody out there that will listen. Mm. Always.
Yeah.
And the Samaritans is a perfect example. Yeah. You know, it's 24/7. If people are having a rough day, a rough hour, you know, there will always be someone on the end of the line to talk to if you're feeling that you're really struggling.
Yeah.
And Papyrus is a similar organisation as well.
And the Samaritans as well, you know, it doesn't just have to be extreme things. You could just talk about, you know, feeling sad or feeling hopeless.
Yeah.
It's
not,
people think, you know, you see, sounds awful, but like if you go Clifton Suspension Bridge, there are phones all the way along the bridge to the Samaritans, and you immediately associate it with suicidal thoughts. But it's not just for that.
Mm.
You just need someone to talk to. You know? There are lots of services out there, so do reach out for help. But we'll put lots of links in the description.
Yeah.
Well, ladies, thank you both for coming. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I think we've touched on some really interesting and not always easy topics, but I've enjoyed it. And hopefully anyone listening has got something out of it. This will go out on World Mental Health Day, which I think is 10th of October. So listen out for that. But thank you very much both for joining me. And I hope you'll come on podcasts again. Maybe we'll do a mental health follow-up, but maybe also we'll do a regular podcast together as well. So
we could have a tea day.
We could convert you.
Okay. I'll think about it. Yeah, I could be persuaded. We could do a couple of drips, tea special. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Called a couple of pots.
Yes.
Yeah, brilliant. That's been brilliant. Thank you very much, both of you. Listening to A Couple of Drips,
The show was conceived and presented by Chris Granger and is a Cup the Mic production.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, Chris here. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to support the production of future episodes, then subscriptions are available. Simply click on the support button in the episode description. See you next time.